This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, listeners. It's Vanessa. For years, Parcast has worked tirelessly to bring you an unprecedented look at history's most radical true crime events. Your support has not only allowed us to keep exploring these stories, but has driven us to keep expanding as well. So as a thank you to the Parcast listeners, I am honored to announce the release of our first book, Cults: Inside the World's Most Notorious Groups and Understanding the People Who Joined Them. It's available on July 12th, and you can pre-order it today at parcast.com/cults. The Branch Davidians, the Ant Hill Kids, Heaven's Gate, and more. Cults combs through the terrifying details never explored in any of Parcast's series before. This is a passion project only made possible by you. So we truly hope you'll enjoy it. Visit parcast.com/cults to pre-order your copy of Cults: Inside the World's Most Notorious Groups and Understanding the People Who Joined Them.
Listener discretion is advised. This episode features discussions of murder, domestic violence, and elder abuse that may be upsetting. We advise extreme caution for listeners under 13. Embarrassment can really stick with us. Whether it's an insult we remember from our high school bully or flack from an ex-lover in a marriage gone wrong, it can be hard to forgive and forget. Especially for nurse Vicky Dawn Jackson. Her personal life was riddled with neglect and abandonment. Early in her career, she worked hard as a nurse, hoping professional successes could soothe the stinging feelings of inferiority. But even then, patients berated her, yet another source of humiliation. Syringe in hand, Vicky Dawn Jackson took her own uncalled-for vengeance. Because she couldn't forgive and forget. This is Medical Murders, a Spotify original from Parcast. For decades, thousands of medical students have taken the Hippocratic Oath. It boils down to do no harm. But a closer look reveals a phrase much more interesting. I must not play at God. However, some doctors break that oath, choosing to play God with their patients, deciding who lives and who dies. Each week on Medical Murders, we'll investigate those who decided to kill. We'll explore the specifics of how they operate, not just on their patients, but within their own minds, examining the psychology and neurology behind heartless medical killers. I'm Alastair Murden, and I'm joined by Dr. David Kipper, MD.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Kipper, and I'm so happy to provide Alastair with some medical insight into our case of Vicky Dawn Jackson, a nurse who was ironically inspired by Florence Nightingale, but whose career ultimately became the antithesis of her iconic and beloved mentor.
You can find episodes of Medical Murders and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify. Just open the app and type Medical Murders in the search bar. This is our one-part episode on nurse Vicky Dawn Jackson. Between December 11th, 2000 and February 18th, 2001, she lethally injected at least 10 patients at a hospital in Nocona, Texas. Today, we'll explore how Vicky's determination to earn respect turned her violent in the face of criticism. We'll also track how she chose her unassuming victims and how law enforcement finally caught on. All this and more coming up. Stay with us. On the evening of January 30th, 2001, 14-year-old Lydia Weathered lay quietly in her hospital room. She'd been admitted days earlier for a painful case of appendicitis. Now, her hands rested gently over her tender abdomen, with her mum sitting at her bedside. Suddenly, a blonde nurse entered and injected a liquid into Lydia's IV. She explained that the medication was a pain reliever, then made a quick exit. Seconds later, Lydia was overcome by a sudden pain. She managed to alert her mother to the tightness in her chest just before she lost the ability to speak. Her mother screamed for help, panicked. But the fast-moving blonde nurse wouldn't be returning to save Lydia. It's hard to know what turns someone into a cold-blooded killer, especially when most of their early life is shrouded in mystery, like Vicky Dawn Jackson's. We do know that when she was 15 in the early 1980s, Vicky and her family moved to the small town of Nocona, Texas. Shortly after, her mother got a job as a cook at the Nocona nursing home. To help bring in money for her working-class family, Vicky cleaned and folded linens in the nursing home's laundry room. Her people skills and hard-working personality quickly earned Vicky a promotion to nurse's aide. This was no small victory. It cemented her dream of becoming a nurse. Her vision initially took form when Vicky learned about Florence Nightingale, the English nurse who pioneered incredible advances in hospital sanitation during the Victorian era. Florence became Vicky's hero. And Vicky may have resolved to impact the world in a similar way. If she could be like Florence, she would feel truly fulfilled and secure. So she set her sights on becoming a registered nurse and put her best efforts into her aide job at the nursing home. But the reality of the gig was grim. Vicky was often scratched, bitten, and berated by her elderly patients. And despite landing an adult job, she was still a teenage girl. Vicky's self-esteem was highly malleable. It didn't take long before the harsh treatment impacted her self-image.
Nursing is a very rewarding career for people with a passion for helping others, but it's not for the faint of heart. It can be particularly difficult when dealing with highly vulnerable or compromised patients, and I've seen the kind of treatment Vicky was experiencing firsthand. It's always important to put patients' behavior into context, and for an elderly nursing home population, cognitive decline and other illnesses may result in some inappropriate lashing out at staff. A nurse's physical safety is crucial, so Vicky really should have had help in dealing with the violent residents. As for the psychological trauma she was undergoing, it would have been humane and valuable for her fellow employees to help put things into perspective. Just like anyone else, healthcare workers need support in processing daily frustrations and insecurities.
But teenage Vicky didn't have any friends to vent to about her experiences as a young nurse's aide. She had no social life outside of work. Classmates described her as friendless, awkward, and a bit of a wallflower, yet another contributor to her growing insecurity. Still, During her junior year of high school, she caught the eye of Johnny McLaughlin. The construction worker, who was 5 years older than her, had recently suffered a major breakup. On the rebound, he started giving his attention to Vicky, something she couldn't help but appreciate. All her life up until this point, she'd been overlooked and under-celebrated. Any high school crushes she may have had always ignored her. But now, a grown man was giving her his attention. It didn't matter to Vicky that she was a full 5 years younger than him. He made her feel loved. He was cute. And after a few months, he asked her to marry him. It was an unhesitating yes from Vicky. Perhaps she thought she'd captured the heart of her Prince Charming. Now all she had to do was become the next Florence Nightingale and live happily ever after. Not quite. Less than a year later, the pair divorced. This likely impacted Vicky's ability to trust others and herself. It may have called her whole life trajectory into question. Still, she pursued her nursing dream. In 1984, when she graduated from high school, she planned to enroll in a junior college program to become a licensed vocational nurse, or LVN. She kept her job at Nakona Nursing Home to save money and accumulate even more hours as a nurse's aide. But she was thrown another curveball when she got pregnant. Vicky and her boyfriend, Leroy Carson, rushed into marriage. Leroy was a young mechanic. Perhaps Vicky thought he could support the family while she went to school. So what if her family life was taking off before her professional one? She was still young, and she had no plans of giving up on her education. In 1985, 19-year-old Vicky gave birth to their first child, Curtis. Their second child, Jennifer, came in 1986. 3 years later, in 1989, Vicky finally became an LVN and was promoted to night shift nurse at the nursing home. It was a major victory, though it came with sacrifices. As a young mother and budding nurse, Vicky barely slept. Her marriage also suffered as Leroy seemed to avoid parental duties. It got so bad that sometimes Vicky brought her children with her on the night shifts.
Sadly, Vicky's situation is pretty common, as many young nurses struggle to balance motherhood and their career. This maneuver is especially difficult when they don't have financial means, help from family or friends, or a supportive partner, all of which Vicky seemed to be dealing with. Bringing her kids with her on night shifts would have been a really difficult situation for her and them for a number of reasons, and unfortunately, hospitals don't offer any kind of childcare resources for employees. Having been a single parent and having brought my own son with me to work plenty of times, I completely empathize with this kind of struggle. There were a couple of times when I had to pull him out of bed at night and take him with me to see a patient, but luckily it was more of a daytime dilemma. In either case, I'd place him somewhere I could see him or with someone working a desk in the immediate area. Fortunately for me, my practice was relatively established by the time he came along, but Vicky's career was in bloom when her kids were still very young. Ultimately, working in healthcare requires a lot of time and resource, which for many can make it a field that prioritizes circumstance over genuine passion.
But Vicky maintained her determination, still chasing her dream of becoming the next Florence Nightingale. And despite Leroy's occasional absence from her and her children's lives, she didn't leave him. Leroy left her. After nearly a decade of marriage, he walked out in 1994. They officially divorced 2 years later. According to Vicky, who was later interviewed by the journalist Skip Hollandsworth for Texas Monthly, Leroy claimed she had become a stupid, boring nurse, and that no one cared about her. But Vicky quickly proved him wrong. By 1997, 31-year-old Vicky was married again, this time to a fellow healthcare provider, Kirk Jackson. As a nursing home aide, he had plenty in common with Vicky. She hoped her new man would understand and respect what it was like to be in the medical field. Shortly after their wedding, Kirk was hired at Nakona General Hospital, one of the smallest hospitals in the state of Texas, and Vicky quickly joined him. Maybe she felt that working with her husband would keep him from leaving her. Not quite. A few months into the marriage, Kirk began drinking heavily and flirting with other nurses. Vicky noticed, and they fought constantly. The household became violent and volatile, certainly difficult for Vicky's children, who were now teenagers. In late 1999, Vicky's son Curtis left to live at his dad's house. Vicky's daughter Jennifer soon followed suit. But on her visits home, the 14-year-old grew increasingly concerned for her mum. Jennifer noticed that Vicky frequently stared off into space and zoned out. Over the next year, Vicky's behavior grew more and more erratic. She eventually confided in Jennifer that she might be bipolar. When Jennifer asked what that meant, her mother replied coldly, "It means I could kill you and get away with it." Up next, Nurse Vicky snaps.
Hi, listeners. It's Carter from Parcast Network. It's the perfect time to grab yourself a second helping of the Spotify original from Parcast, Devious Dads. Our limited series is back with a new collection of episodes from across the network, exposing the unfortunate families whose patriarchs had a penchant for causing pain. Criminal masterminds, spies, murderers. Every Sunday on Spotify, Devious Dads features the fathers who chose to put the fear of God into those they tormented, including their own families. Some men raise children, others raise hell. Be sure to follow Season 2 of Devious Dads free and only on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Now, back to the story. By December 2000, 34-year-old nurse Vicky Dawn Jackson had reached a peak in her nursing career, revered for her professionalism and charming bedside manner. But as much as Vicky might have wanted, validation at work couldn't make up for the mounting pressures in her personal life. After scaring her daughter with her bouts of dissociation, Vicky told her she might have bipolar disorder. Her marriage to her third husband, Kirk Jackson, was also failing, largely due to his flirtatious behavior with other women. Her dream to become the next Florence Nightingale was, at this point, a lifeline. But as Vicky's troubles took hold, maybe she began to drift from it, deciding instead to take out her frustrations on hospital patients, particularly the ones she knew. Since Vicky had lived in Nakona since high school and Nakona General was a small hospital, she had a level of familiarity with many patients and their families. She knew whose relatives had teased her in her teen years. She knew who had high social standing, something she'd never attained herself. And she knew she wanted to make anyone who'd ever humiliated her pay. It began with 100-year-old Donnie Jennings, the matriarch of a prominent local family. On December 11th, 2000, the elderly widow was being treated at the hospital for constipation and dehydration. Vicky was one of the nurses checking in on her. But Donnie wasn't an easy patient. She often struck out and spat at her caretakers and complained constantly. This time, it seemed Vicky decided she wasn't gonna take it. Based on what happened shortly after midnight on December 11th, we can piece together one possible course of events. As the hospital's workers settled into their overnight shifts, Vicky quietly headed to the nearest medical supply closet and filled a syringe with mevacurium chloride.
Mevacurium chloride is a powerful neuromuscular blocking agent. The drug relaxes skeletal muscle and is used alongside general anesthesia to enable tracheal intubation prior to mechanical ventilation or surgery. Its use helps facilitate intubation, doesn't cause aspiration or any other unwanted physical reactions. Judging by the condition she was admitted for, I can't think of any reasons the 100-year-old Donnie Jennings would need this medication.
But Vicky didn't hesitate to administer it to Donnie. Within moments, Donnie turned blue, struggling to breathe. The mevacurium chloride had worked its way into her system. Vicky watched as Donnie gasped for air, but she had no intention of helping her. Donnie Jennings' lifeless body was found at 1:45 a.m. on December 11th, 2000. She had died after going into respiratory arrest.
Mevacurium chloride was definitely the culprit in this case. For the medication to work as intended, prior sedation is crucial, and pain management drugs are usually necessary in combination. Incorrect use of the drug, like administering a large dose on its own, could render a patient completely panicked and incapable of breathing. Again, this happens because it paralyzes skeletal muscles, including those involved in respiration. Since mevacurium chloride itself doesn't induce sedation or an analgesic response, someone succumbing to its effects would likely be conscious and distressed, struggling to breathe. In her final moments before dying from respiratory arrest, Donnie had to have been very frightened, and she must have been disoriented from this, as well as her dwindling oxygen levels. It's very sad that this was her end, especially given the simplicity of her alleged medical issues. She wouldn't have died from them.
Vicky knew that. Donnie had made Vicky's life difficult, so she had ended her life. This isn't to blame the victim. As Dr. Kipper mentioned earlier, there are plenty of ways to handle a crotchety patient. None involving murder. Even if Donnie had been a dream patient, Vicky still might have killed her. Because that morning, it appears Vicky experienced a sense of control and superiority for the first time in years. And she'd gotten away with it. Though Donnie had only been treated for constipation and dehydration, her passing at age 100 didn't spark any suspicion. Of course, her family still grieved. And Vicky was eager to comfort them. Over the phone, Vicky spoke with Donnie's daughter, Javine. As Javine shared her shock and anguish, Vicky seemed to internalize a smug sense that her life wasn't so bad. This woman had lost her mother. Perhaps for a brief and glowing moment, Vicky's own pain paled in comparison. Outwardly, Vicky masked her satisfaction with feigned sympathy, exclaiming, "Oh, Javine, life can be so hard sometimes. I personally know so well how hard it can be. I cannot tell you how sorry I am for your loss." But as her subsequent actions would prove, Vicky wasn't sorry. She was eager to feel that smug glow again. 9 days later, on the morning of December 20th, 2000, another patient got on her bad side. 87-year-old LG Hudson was a local farmer who'd been hospitalized at Nakona General for a broken leg. His hands, however, worked just fine. In the past, he'd slapped Vicky's rear end several times. It was certainly crude, and it also may have triggered memories of Vicky's humiliation at the hands of her ex-husbands. But on this day, Vicky must have realized the taunting was nothing she couldn't fix with a fresh syringe of mevacurium chloride. She silently injected LG with it. 20 minutes later, she walked into the room of 62-year-old Sanford Mitchell, who continuously stared and commented on her breasts. She injected him too. In the hours that followed, medical teams frantically tried to resuscitate these two men, who both seemed to be in decent health hours prior. Despite these efforts, both patients died. Vicky's body count was now 3 people, and while the small-town hospital might have found the deaths tragic, no one seemed to suspect they were murders. When Christmas Eve arrived, Vicky gave herself the gift of revenge. 50-year-old Barbara Atterbury and 87-year-old Boyd Burnett had both been recently admitted to the hospital. According to Skip Hollandsworth's reporting for Texas Monthly, both had relatives who had teased Vicky in high school more than 15 years prior. Apparently, Vicky remembered them well. She sprung into action with her usual weapon, a full syringe of mevacurium chloride. And once again, she killed 2 patients with no eyebrows raised. It certainly made the holiday season heavy for those who had tainted Vicky's past. Vicky made sure of it, in some cases talking to her former bullies on the phone, as she had with Donnie Jennings' daughter. And maybe talking to the bereaved made her feel a little less alone during the holiday season, because she kept killing. On December 29th, 2000, Vicky took the lives of 2 more patients. This amounted to 7 sudden deaths following respiratory arrest and Acona General in less than a month, all during Vicky's night shifts. And all under strange circumstances, with patients who had not been hospitalized for life-threatening illnesses. It's hard to believe anyone at the hospital didn't suspect something was wrong, but the administration appeared aloof. As journalist Skip Hollandsworth reported in 2007, at least some members of the hospital staff brushed the deaths off as a run of bad luck. They also pointed out how many of the patients had been older and that death rates for the elderly typically rise significantly during the winter months.
Seasonal differences in mortality rates affect all age groups, and elderly deaths tend to increase during the winter months. Much of this has to do with changes in weather and temperature and a reduced amount of sunlight. There's also an increase of infectious illnesses like viruses and flu, more substance abuse, and unhealthier eating habits during the winter holidays. However, a death spike like this is wildly abnormal in less than a month, regardless of the time of year, especially in such a small hospital. Though sad, administrations will typically look to general correlations before jumping to darker conclusions.
While the administration had their assumptions, the Nakona locals weren't so sure that the winter season was to blame. Rumors spread throughout town, and Nakona hospital employees even began to refer to the night shift as the killing crew, since that's when most of the recent deaths had occurred. It may have been a light joke, but it held the dark truth. Someone at Nakona was a killer. Still, no legitimate action was taken to investigate the fatalities. For Vicky, it was practically an invitation to keep killing. And as the new year came, that's exactly what she did. In mid-January 2001, nurses found a pneumonia patient who had passed away. He had been lethally injected by Vicky. This victim seemed to be a random pick with no clear motive, which may suggest that Vicky was growing bolder and more unhinged with her crimes. Barely 3 hours later, she killed 78-year-old John Williams, whose son had been Vicky's crush in high school. Vicky likely loved the attention Pat Williams gave her when she told him his father had died. But that wasn't enough. On January 24th, nurses found 95-year-old Omar Weiler had stopped breathing, shortly after Vicky had tended to her. The nurses successfully resuscitated Omar, but Vicky managed to slide back into the hospital room 4 days later and attack Omar again. Omar wouldn't survive the second dose of mivercurium chloride. At this point, Vicky seemed as though she was most concerned with the sense of power each murder gave her, a kind that she had never quite felt before, a kind that Florence Nightingale might have had. And much like Florence, Vicky's impact on her hospital would soon make her famous. Coming up, Nurse Vicky's crimes spark a heated investigation.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Sound the gifting panic alarm. You need to get an amazing gift. Wait, no, the perfect gift. Relax. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Now, back to the story. By the end of January 2001, 34-year-old Vicky Dawn Jackson is thought to have killed nearly a dozen patients at Nakona General Hospital. Some had reportedly antagonized her at work, and others were relatives of her old classmates. But a few of her victims seemed random. And while rumors may have been swirling about town, the facility's management didn't seem suspicious of their noteworthy nurse. They took out an ad in the local paper praising her and other staff members for their contributions. Star quality, the title of the advertisement in the Nakona News read. Displayed front and center in her scrubs was a photo of nurse-turned-murderer Vicky Dawn Jackson. But Vicky couldn't hide in plain sight forever. In late January 2001, a technician who worked at the hospital pharmacy made a shocking discovery. Several vials of mivercurium chloride were missing from the crash carts at Nakona General.
For a hospital to legally gain licensure, it has to meet certain insurance requirements and implement mandates for medication handling. Pharmacy technicians have the important responsibility of assisting in implementing protocols for medication audits and record keeping. These drug evaluations are done monthly, and they're critical in monitoring for expired medications and shortages, maintaining emergency drug reserves, and reviewing the prescribing habits for the staff physicians. In relation to our story, it's not completely unreasonable that it took a month for staff to notice the missing mivercurium chloride. There could have been some negligence involved, but it's also possible Vicky just got lucky in her timing. Either way, there's really no excuse when it comes to something like this.
It may have taken a month for the missing drug to spark alarm, but once it was out, suspicions grew. The discovery created a direct line from the sudden spike in deaths back to the hospital staff. In the final week of January, the possibility of malpractice was growing increasingly plausible. On January 30th, 2001, Vicky began her shift as usual. she made her first rounds to see her patients for the night. One of them, 82-year-old Orvel Moore, was a well-known local rancher. Over the past couple of days, he had been feisty and abrasive when she checked on him. Vicky ignored his offhand banter at first, until it got too personal. At one point, he'd made a rude comment about her weight. Vicky felt a familiar rage rushing to the surface. She couldn't let him get away with it. Now, we don't know exactly what followed, but it may have looked something like this. Vicky entered the nearest medical supply closet, filling a fresh syringe with mucocurium chloride. She opened the door to the hallway cautiously, making sure not to be seen as she made her way back to Orvel's hospital room. Then, she silently inserted the medication into Orvel's IV. Minutes later, a doctor and team of nurses rushed in, responding to a crash of Orvel's vitals. They had yet another respiratory arrest on their hands. Caught up trying to save another one of Vicky's victims, no one noticed her slip out of the room and head towards a different one. 14-year-old Lydia Weathered had been admitted to the hospital days prior for appendicitis. And despite her young age, Vicky knew her too. According to journalist Skip Hollandsworth, there had recently been rumors circulating amongst the town's teens that Lydia had rejected Vicky's son's romantic advances. As always, Vicky was resolved to get revenge, even if it wasn't entirely for herself. She injected the teen with mucocurium chloride without a second thought. 14-year-old Lydia was her youngest known victim so far. But Nakona General was well staffed on the evening of January 30th. After attempting to save Orvel Moore, doctors rushed to Lydia's side, reviving her. Quite strangely, neither Lydia nor her mum realized that her medical emergency had been the result of the nurse who had injected her IV. Though she'd gone undetected, Vicky grew agitated. She'd have to strike again. Early the next morning, before the end of her shift at 7 a.m., Vicky tiptoed into the hospital rooms of two middle-aged women, spiking their IV bags. As they had earlier in the shift, doctors and nurses jumped into action, and while one victim was saved, the other never regained consciousness. If the past couple of months hadn't gotten Nakona General's administration's attention, January 30th, 2001, certainly did. Four respiratory arrests in one night, and a lot of Nurse Vicky. Now that hospital staff were starting to look into all the deaths, they began to notice a peculiar pattern. Vicky was always the last to check on patients who stopped breathing abruptly. And she frequently insisted on breaking the news of patient deaths to the families she knew. Hospital leaders were aware of the missing mucocurium chloride vials from crash carts around the tiny hospital. But ultimately, Vicky's connection to each of the dead patients could have been a tragic coincidence. Without evidence, law enforcement couldn't arrest any one staff member. The hospital would have to wait for another respiratory emergency to give them the proof they needed. And this time, they'd be prepared. With the assistance of local police, Nakona General Hospital CEO Charles Norris set up a camera in at least one location where mucocurium chloride was stored. By February 2001, the camera was ready and waiting to capture the culprit. And unknowing, Vicky struck again. On the morning of February 17th, 2001, she slipped into the hospital room of 61-year-old Donnelly Reed, who had made a full recovery from post-polio syndrome. He was set to return home in the next couple of days. Vicky injected medication into his IV, asked with a smile if he needed anything else, then exited. Moments later, Donnelly grew lightheaded and unable to breathe. Luckily, a doctor found and resuscitated him, saving his life.
Even though multiple victims survived Vicky's attacks, many probably sustained long-term damage from them. Prolonged respiratory strain without adequate oxygen intake can lead to long-standing cognitive impairment, compromised lung function, skeletal muscle weakness, and damage to other organs. Patients experiencing these issues would have to adhere to ongoing care, and their mobility and overall quality of life could really take a turn for the worse. On top of this, the horrifying ordeal that Vicky so generously provided to her patients surely left them with psychological trauma, which can be particularly taxing and even dangerous for the elderly. These people truly were lucky to have their lives at the end of the day. But after an assault like this, victims like Donnelly Reed would have needed ample care and time to fully recover.
However, Donnelly was hardly given a moment to rest. Hospital administrators needed to know which nurse had last tended to Donnelly before his respiratory emergency. Donnelly recalled a full-figured nurse with blonde hair and a sugary sweet accent. A clear description of Vicky Dawn Jackson. This ID was enough for law enforcement to search Vicky's home for the missing drugs. A team of Texas Rangers and the FBI rushed onto the scene. After tearing the house apart, they found what they were looking for. An empty syringe in a garbage can. Lab tests later proved that it contained traces of mevacurium chloride. Both Vicky and her husband Kirk were questioned and immediately fired by Nakona General Hospital, though Kirk wasn't implicated in the deaths. Perhaps stunned that he'd been married to an accused murderer, Kirk skipped town. Vicky stuck around, appearing unaffected as police questioned her. She denied, denied, and denied, apparently hoping it would blow over. But the impact of the investigation was undeniable. Vicky was forced to switch careers, taking work as a deli sandwich maker at a grocery store in the nearby town of Bowie. There was no way she'd ever be Florence Nightingale now. But unwilling to accept that she'd ruined her career, personal life, and future, Vicky continually denied wrongdoing. Ultimately, they didn't need a confession from her. The bodies of 10 were exhumed, all of them presumed to be Vicky's victims. Each revealed traces of mevacurium chloride. During 2001, families of the murdered patients sued the hospital for their negligence in not catching Vicky sooner. Nearly a year later, in July 2002, Vicky was finally arrested. After years of jockeying by prosecutors and the defense team, she pleaded no contest to the murders, meaning she didn't plead guilty, but she also didn't choose to fight the accusations. Maybe it was a matter of maintaining her own innocence, yet another effort to escape humiliation. But if she wanted to come off as an empathetic woman, incapable of harm, she didn't act like it. While awaiting trial in jail, Vicky allegedly had no reaction to being shown photos of the exhumed victims. She didn't seem to have a remorseful bone in her body. Maybe it was because, when it came down to it, Vicky had always deemed her actions justified. She thought those patients deserved it.
Vicky Dawn Jackson clearly couldn't separate her personal feelings from her role as a caretaker. It's frightening enough to think of such a vindictive individual entering into any professional field, but someone like this with authority in the healthcare arena is beyond petrifying. Vicky's is also a case that amazes me to some extent in its simplicity, one method of killing with the mevacurium chloride and one motive, revenge. There's even something oddly straightforward in her refusal to acknowledge any personal wrongdoing. In many ways, she's a classic textbook villain. While her murders may have been justified in her own mind, no patient should be killed due to their behavior, even on the worst day of their life, or because of a family member's worst day, for that matter.
The judge and jury saw this clearly. Vicky was sentenced to life in prison for the murders. As of this recording, Vicky remains incarcerated at the Christina Melton Crane Unit in Gatesville, Texas. Her earliest possible parole date is in 2042, when she turns 76. Coincidentally, she will be around the same age as many of her victims. Perhaps Vicky would deem that unfair. But given her crime's eye-for-an-eye logic, some might just call it poetic justice. Thanks for listening to Medical Murders, and thanks again to Dr. Kipper for joining me today.
Thanks very much, Alistair.
For more information on Nurse Vicky Dawn Jackson, among the many sources we used, we found Skip Hollandsworth's article, Angel of Death, printed in the July 2007 issue of Texas Monthly, as well as the Vicky Dawn Jackson episode of Nurses Who Kill, extremely helpful to our research. You can find all episodes of Medical Murders and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify. We'll see you next time. Medical Murders is a Spotify original from Parcast. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound designed by Brendan Hawkins, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Trent Williamson, Carly Madden, and Joshua Kern. This episode of Medical Murders was written by Asia Gallo, with writing assistance by Lauren DeLille and Maggie Admire, fact-checking by Bennett Logan, and research by Chelsea Wood. Medical Murders stars Dr. David Kipper and Alastair Murden.
Hi, it's Carter from Parcast Network. Devious Dads is back for a second season and a new collection of hair-raising episodes from across our catalog of shows. Every Sunday, meet the parents who were anything but protectors. Follow Devious Dads free and only on Spotify.
Hi, listeners, it's Vanessa. Exciting news, Parcast's first book, Cults, Inside the World's Most Notorious Groups and Understanding the People Who Join Them, is now available for pre-order at parcast.com/cults. Thanks to your support, we've compiled years of research, insights, and a catalog of case studies to expose more about these cults and the people behind them than ever before. Details which haven't even been explored in our Cults podcast. Visit parcast.com/cults to pre-order your copy of Cults, Inside the World's Most Notorious Groups and Understanding the People Who Join Them.